Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned into another episode of Real College Podcast, Quarantine Edition, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. During the pandemic, I, like the rest of you, have undoubtedly consumed way too much media. From binge-watching my favorite shows and playing games with my friends, it seems like the screens never end. One particular genre of media that has been a staple for myself and others here at Real College Podcast is true crime. In this extra special episode of Real College Podcast, True Crime Edition, we take a dive into the ghoulish history of the Glensheen Mansion, as well as hear from our fellow gophers about their favorite true crime stories, and to top it all off, we'll be analyzing how an attempted axe murder forever changed library security. You won't want to miss this. Be sure to stick around. In our first segment, we will hear from producer Emma Morris as she tells us the story of Glensheen Mansion in all of its horror. Here's Emma with more.
Today, I'm going to retell the story of one of the most beautiful estates in Minnesota and the dark history behind it. Built at the turn of the 20th century and sitting on 12 acres of land off the shore of Lake Superior, Glensheen Mansion, former residence of the Congdons, has 39 rooms and is home to three murders. Our first murder happened years before the mansion was built. In 1880, St. Louis County started issuing licenses for Sunday beer gardens, and the son of a prominent family who owned the land prior to the Congdons purchased one and held an event on Sunday, June 27, 1880. Things were getting increasingly boisterous, and a fight broke out between James Brennan and another man. Edward Brennan, James's brother, tried to break up the fight. But then Herman Oppel, son of Christian Oppel, who was known to have opened the first grocery store in Duluth, decided to get involved. Herman decided to strike Edward behind the ear with his cane, whose head was made of lead. Brennan collapsed and just minutes later passed away. Around 25 years later, Glensheen started construction, beginning in 1905 and finishing in 1908. As stated earlier, it was home to Chester Congdon, who gained his fortune working as a lawyer for the Oliver Mining Company and through investments in the Mesabi Iron Range. On June 27, 1977, 97 years after the murder of Edward Brennan, Elizabeth Congdon and her nurse Velma met the same fate. The mansion was broken into, and around 3 in the morning, Velma was beaten to death with a candlestick. Then, Elizabeth was smothered with a satin pillow in her bedroom. Elizabeth was the last living child of Chester, leaving her the sole heiress of her father's wealth. She was not married. So, who could have done this? Well, in Elizabeth's late 30s, she adopted two daughters, Marjorie and Jennifer. Marjorie was known to be the odd one out, and was diagnosed as a sociopath at a young age. She also married twice, once to Dick Leroy, whom she had 7 children with, and divorced after 20 years. She then married Roger Caldwell, and the two kept asking Elizabeth for money, apparently so they could purchase a horse ranch. After Elizabeth's death, Marjorie was to inherit $8 million, so all signs pointed to Marjorie and her husband following the murder. Roger was tried first, found guilty, and given 2 life sentences for the murders. After that, Marjorie was also charged with conspiracy to commit murder. Roger was later offered a plea deal, confessed to both murders, in 1983, and was freed after serving 5 years in prison. Marjorie committed more crimes following the murder of her mother, serving 2 prison terms for arson, and has even been linked to more strange and mysterious deaths. Her husband passed just over a decade after the murders, but she seems to still be alive and spending the rest of her days in Arizona on probation. This is the story of the Glensheen Estate. For Real College Podcast, I'm Emma Morris.
As the popularity of true crime as a genre has increased, so have the options for fans. It can be very difficult to find just the right thriller to satisfy one's craving. Luckily, here to fill us in on the student's choice for scariest stories is reporter Ethan Olson with more.
True crime stories are becoming as popular as ever. Shows like the new Night Stalker series grace the top of the Netflix charts, so I took to campus to find out which of these stories is most popular, and to see if there are any that we're missing out on.
What is your favorite true crime story and why? Night Stalker on Netflix, and just for the suspense and basically the drama, and to look back into Los Angeles when it was still under like the corruption and all the violence that was still going on, and it was just really eye-opening and intriguing to watch.
My favorite true crime story is Zodiac. It's filmed by David Fincher. It's about the Zodiac killings, obviously. Not really a true crime junkie or anything, but Zodiac is, it's an exception to this. It's actually made me interested in following the updates to the Zodiac killer case. Like, actually recently there were some like Belgian coders who decoded one of the messages from the Zodiac killer. The film itself, it's not even a horror movie, but it's one of the few movies that's genuinely frightened me in at least a few scenes. It's a very, you know, just a very well-made film overall.
The Ted Bundy movie from Netflix with Zac Efron, because it was just amazing, so good, pristine.
Mine is Jeffrey Epstein, like any documentaries or podcasts about him, because it's super interesting to listen to how he was suicided and stuff and the conspiracies surrounding him.
My favorite true crime story is the story of Ted Bundy. The reason why is solely because when you hear about the victims, it's clear that before he encountered every single victim, they all said how they were charmed by him and he came across as a very nice and a very, you know, just, they did not expect what he was capable of. I think that goes to show that you can never truly judge a book by its cover, you know? It kind of just goes on to say how we live in a time now where it's filled with a lot of people just kind of judging people and like just kind of assuming any kind of thing about anybody. But then in a time like this, when you hear a story like that, it just makes you think, hey, maybe I should give everybody a chance, you know? And I shouldn't just assume everybody's a certain way, because you never know what could happen. You could assume something and then it turns out fatal.
JonBenet Ramsey, just because it's very unknown, it's really old, but yet it's still really popular and talked about a lot today. And there's so many theories and everybody thinks it's an inside or like the family, but we still don't know.
This isn't my favorite, but it's the first one that comes to my mind. It's the murder of Junko Furuta, and it's just probably the most graphic murder I've ever heard of. And heard about it first on TikTok, and then I had to go Google it to find out what it was about, and it's probably the scariest thing I've ever read. And I'm a huge fan of all those BuzzFeed true crime stuff, so I have a pretty high threshold for like graphic, gory things, but this is probably the worst thing I've ever read. It gave me chills, which I normally don't get. But it's not my favorite just because it's horrible what happened to her, but it's the first thing I thought of when you said true crime.
My favorite true crime story is the Axeman of New Orleans, because I think it is really creepy, and I thought it was interesting that he was a fan of jazz music and spared people's lives if they played jazz music.
This time out, we heard from Abby, Saw, Andrew, Hannah, Grace, Alyssa, Angeline, and Jack, and I would like to thank them all for participating. It's interesting and a little frightening that there are many different crime stories that people pay close attention to. As for me, this is Ethan Olson of Radio K signing out.
On May 2nd, 1979, then 24-year-old Susan Oldenburg was pulling a late-night study session in Memorial Library on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. Being the dedicated scholar that she was, the graduate student preoccupied with her studies didn't notice that she was not alone in her study room. Fortunately, Susan survived her fateful encounter that night with Eugene DeVoe, who was later identified by local authorities as the man that tried to kill Susan with a fire axe. To get an idea of what happened that night, and how the Axe in the Stacks incident, as it has been coined, has impacted library security, I spoke with Dennis Bloom, a security guard at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
My name's Dennis Bloom. My position, in 1985, I started working at College Library, which is the undergrad library, and my position there, security, patrol the floors, look for different incidents and library theft of library materials, personal property theft, trying to keep people out of the library. It was a whole new experience for me dealing, you know, with all the students. I enjoyed the students, but there was also other people that would frequent the library that would come in that were not students.
Although it happened before Dennis's career in library security began, the axe in the stacks forever impacted his time as a security officer.
Security experience as a security officer working for the libraries. Mm-hmm. I started at College Library and went to Memorial Library, and that's where the axe attack happened. And that changed everything. A fire axe was used, this mental subject used it, attacked a female patron and started choking her, hit her in the head, and so they changed the whole entrance where it was only one way to enter with ID check. You needed, obviously, a UW ID, but then they were issuing day passes. They changed and they had more of a presence of security as far as police being there and security. So they did beef up security at Memorial Library.
The axe in the stacks forever changed security at the UW-Madison campus. But how did this high-profile incident impact us here at the U of M, a mere 4 hours away? To help me answer this question, I enlisted the help of Lisa German, the university librarian and dean of libraries.
You know, it really varies from place to place, but we're not unusual. When you were talking, I didn't even know about the axe in the stacks. I knew about a murder in the stacks at Penn State because I worked there, so that I knew about. I think the university and the libraries places, we want this to be a safe campus, right? Of course. And we pay pretty close attention to this. Currently there's at the health sciences campus, there's increased security there in the health sciences right now.
After mentioning an increased security presence in the health sciences library, I had to ask Lisa and Mark Ingebretson, the library's director of communications, if this was in response to the syringe stabbing incident that took place last year.
I think that was one of the incidents that, I don't know all of them, but that was one of the incidents that led to the university's decision to provide enhanced security.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my understanding is there was a number of other incidents that had happened, incidents being, I don't know all of the details, but there was a large homeless population and patients weren't feeling safe is my understanding. But I think there was some other, I think when the light rail went in, I think they started to see an increase in suspicious activity and maybe some minor incidents. So they were already considering some enhanced security for that sector, especially with the opening of the new health sciences education center. And then what happened at the health sciences library, then called the biomedical library, was the syringe incident was one of those incidents, but that isn't why they did it. It was just one additional incident.
The syringe incident and the axe in the stacks are very different, but somewhat similar. In both scenarios, the victim fortunately survived. And in both situations, the perpetrator was later identified to be unaffiliated with the respective university where it took place. According to Dennis, public access to the UW's libraries frequently resulted in problems for him and other security officers.
They didn't check IDs of people coming in, so you never knew who was actually coming in, if they were affiliated or not. So I got to meet some of the people that were homeless occasionally, and we had one person that would come in who's well known all over campus, Tunnel Bob. His name is Bob Grunewald, but this Tunnel Bob, I got to meet him and get him to leave, and I was fortunate. I really never had any major confrontations, but it was a new experience, and I was introduced to a new concept that I didn't mm-hmm. expect to find in a library, and that was everything that can happen outside happens inside.
Although the UW has restricted public access to its libraries in the aftermath of the attack, the University of Minnesota has taken a much different approach by being fully accessible with minimal security, according to university librarian Lisa German.
Personally, I think it's a very positive thing. We're a land-grant university, and libraries take, we take our outreach mission very seriously. So from my perspective, it's very positive. Now, it's a little bit different right now because all of the buildings on campus, just and the libraries included, are only accessible to folks with their U card.
According to Lisa, the libraries on campus are very safe.
So I think from what we hear, students feel pretty safe in our libraries. Same with faculty and the public. You know, there have been a few incidents, just like there are in all universities, and that's why we use security monitors and we keep a close watch on the security incidents for sure.
In order to fully understand what goes on behind the scenes at the libraries here on campus, I need someone on the inside. Fortunately, I was able to speak with a student library assistant on the condition that I kept their identity a secret.
I'm a student library assistant, which means that I shelve books. I sometimes work at some of the desks to answer patrons' questions. A typical day, my tasks change based on the day. So some days I'm mostly shelving, some days I'm doing divots. Which is the service the library offers.
Although the libraries on campus are usually considered to be safe, my source did express some concerns.
Yeah, I've definitely heard of concerns from my supervisors. I've never personally been in a situation where I felt unsafe, but I know coworkers who have, I know supervisors who have, and that's really upsetting, and I hate that happened to them.
Although they themselves have not felt threatened at work, this was not the case for Dennis during his time at the UW.
I've been threatened. I've been, you know, other things going on, and those are memorable, and I'm very, very thankful for the UW police coming in and assisting, you know, and getting these people out. Mm-hmm. You know, I have no, that's not part of my job. I'm not allowed to any physical contact. Mm-hmm. I'm only trying to provide information to assist the police in removing people. I would physically get involved if some staff person or someone was involved in a situation. I might be forced that way, but otherwise, it's all strictly UW police.
For anyone frequenting a University of Minnesota library, here is Mark, the library's director of communications, with some resources you can use to keep yourself safe.
If you're studying late at night at a library, the university has a campus security monitor escort service 24/7. And I think I've got it called up here, 612-624-WALK. And so a student can always call that number to get if they want to get back to their residence hall after leaving the library safely.
Although the libraries on campus are remarkably safe, there is no such thing as somewhere completely safe in a big city like Minneapolis. Like Dennis said, anything that can happen outside of a library can happen inside. But most importantly, look after your fellow gophers. There's no better safety policy than one big family looking out for each other. Reporting for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe. That's all for the true crime episode of Real College Podcast. Congratulations, you made it to the end. As always, stay safe, Minnesota. We hope you stay happy, healthy, and connected. Until next time, signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.